adulation, joy, pain, nausea, the burden, the need. She slipped off her Grecian helm with its tall green feathers and handed it to a worshipful female trainer. One of her fellow players, a massive reserve guard, was emboldened by the frenzy of victory.
"Give us a big wet smack, Landry," he giggled, gathering her in before she could sidestep.
An instant later, he was spread-eagled against the corridor wall. Felice laughed. A beat later, the others joined in.
"Some other time, Danny Precious."
Her eyes, brown and very large, met those of the other athlete. He felt as though something had taken him by the throat. The girl, the coach, and most of the crowd passed on, heading for the dressing rooms where the reporters were waiting. Only the importunate guard was left behind, sliding slowly down the wall to sit, panting quietly, feet stuck out and arms limp at his sides. A medic driving a meat wagon found him there a few minutes later and helped him to his feet.
"Jeez, guy, and you weren't even in the game!"
With a sheepish scowl, Benny admitted what had happened. The medical attendant wagged his head in amazement.
"You have a lot of nerve making a pass. Sweet face that she is, that little broad scares me shitless."
The guard nodded, brooding.
"You know, she likes shooting the guys down. I mean, she actually gets her bang from it. Only you can see she just assumed the poor sod was dead as snoozing. You grab? She's a freak. A gorgeous, talent-loaded, champion, bitch-kitty freak."
The medic made a face.
"Why else would a woman play this crazy game? Come on, hero. I'll give you a lift to the infirmary. We've got just the thing for that wonky feeling in your tummy."
The guard climbed onto the cart beside a snoring casualty.
17 years old. Can you imagine what she's going to be like when she grows up?" "Jocks like you shouldn't have an imagination. It gets in the way of the game plan."
The medic gunned the cart down the corridor toward the sound of distant laughter and shouting. Outside, in the arena, the cheering had stopped. 5.
"Try again, Elizabeth."
She concentrated all of her mind's strength on the projective sense, what there was left of it. Hyperventilating, and with heart racing, she strained until she seemed to be floating free of the chair. "Project from the plaque in front of you. Smile greeting. To you, Kong Cheng Mei, therapist, from Elizabeth Orm, far speaker. If I had the wings of an angel, over these prison walls I would fly. Ends."
"Try again, Elizabeth."
She did, again and again and again, send that ironic little message that she had chosen herself. A sense of humor is evidence of personality integration. Send it, send it. The door to the booth opened, and Kwong came in at last.
"I'm sorry, Elizabeth, but I still don't get a flicker."
"Not even the smile?"
"I'm sorry, not yet. There are no images at all, only the simple carrier. Look, dear, why don't we wrap it up for today? The vital signs monitors has you in the yellow. You really need more rest, more time to heal. You're trying too hard."
Elizabeth Orme leaned back and pressed her fingers to her aching temples.
"Why do we keep up the pretense, Chun Mei?
We know there is slightly better than zip probability that I'll ever function as a metaphysic again. The tank did a beautiful job of putting me back together after the accident. No scars, no aberrations. I'm a fine, normal, healthy specimen of female humanity. Normal. And that's all, folks."
"Elizabeth." The therapist's eyes were filled with compassion. "Give yourself a chance. It was almost a complete neocortical regeneration. We don't understand why you didn't regain your metafunctions together with your other mental faculties. But given time and work, you may very well recover."
"No one with my sort of injury ever has."
"No," came the reluctant admission. "But there is hope, and we must keep trying to get through. You're still one of us, Elizabeth. We want you operant again, no matter how long it takes, but you must keep trying."
"Keep trying to teach a blind woman to see the 3 full moons of Denali.
keep trying to teach a deaf woman to appreciate Bach, or a tongueless one to sing Bellini. Oh, yes.
You're a good friend, Chun Mei, and God knows you've worked hard with me. But it would be healthier if I just accepted the loss. After all, think of the billions of ordinary people who live happy and fulfilling lives without any metaphysic functions at all. I simply must adapt to a new perspective.
Give up the memory of the mind's angel wings lost. Be happy inside the prison walls of my own skull. Forget the beautiful unity, the synergy, the exultant bridging from world to world, the never-afraid warmth of companion souls, the joy of leading child metis to full operancy. Forget the dead identity of dead Lawrence. Oh, yes. Kuang hesitated.
Why don't you follow Czarnecki's advice and take a good long vacation on some warm, peaceful world? Tuamotu, Riviera, Tamiami, even old Earth. When you return, we can begin again with simple pictorials.
That might be just the thing for me, Chun Mei.
But the slight emphasis wasn't lost on the therapist, whose lips tightened in concern. Kuang did not speak, fearing to cause even deeper pain. Elizabeth put on her fur-lined cloak and peered through the drapes covering the office window.
Good grief, just look how the storm has picked up. I'd be a fool not to grab at a chance to escape this Denali winter. I hope my poor egg will start. It was the only one in the transport pool this morning, and it's very nearly ready for the scrap heap.
Like its driver. The therapist followed Elizabeth Orne to the door and placed one hand on her shoulder in impulsive empathy, projecting peace, projecting hope.
You're not to lose courage. You owe it to yourself and to the entire meta community to keep on trying. Your place is with us.
Elizabeth smiled. It was a tranquil face with only a few fine lines about the corners of the eyes, stigmata of deep emotion subsequent to the regeneration that had restored her broken 44-year-old body to the perfection of young adulthood. As easily as a crayfish grows new limbs, she had grown new cells to replace smashed arms and ribcage and pelvis, lungs and heart and abdominal organs, shattered bone and gray matter of her skull and forebrain. The regeneration had been virtually perfect, so the doctors had said. Oh, yes. She gave the therapist's hand a gentle squeeze.
Goodbye, Chun Mei. Until the next time.
Never. Never again. She went out into the snow, ankle deep already. The illuminated office windows of the Denali Institute of Metapsychology made squarish golden patterns on the white quadrangle. Frank, the custodian, gave her a wave as he plied a shovel along the walk. The melting system must have broken down again. Good old Denali. She would not be coming back to the Institute where she had worked for so many years. First as a student, then as counseling far speaker and redactor, finally, as patient. The continuing pain of deprivation was more than her sanity could bear, and Elizabeth was basically a practical woman. It was time for something completely different. Filled with purpose, clutching the hood of her cloak closely about her head, she headed for the egg park. As was her custom now, she moved her lips as she prayed. Blessed Diamond Mask, guide me on my way to exile. 6. Admitting the human race to the galactic milieu in advance of its socio-political maturation had been risky. Even after the first metaphysic human threat to milieu security had been put down by the venerated Jack and Elusio, there persisted stubborn evidence of humanity's original sin. People such as Aiken Drum. Aiken was one of those peculiar personalities who drive behavior modification specialists to distraction. He was normally chromosomed, his brain was undamaged, undiseased, and of superior intelligence quotient. It was crammed with latent metafunctions that might, in due time, be coaxed into operancy. His childhood nurturing on the newly founded colony of Dalriada was no different from that of the other 30,000 non-borns who were engendered from the sperm and ova of carefully selected Scottish forebears.
But Aiken had been different from the rest of the hatch. He was a natural crook. Despite the love of surrogate parents, the devotion of skilled teachers, and the inevitable corrective courses administered almost continuously throughout his stormy adolescence, Aiken stubbornly clung to his destined path of knavery. He stole, he lied, he cheated when he felt he could get away with it. He took joy in breaking the rules and was contemptuous of peers with normal psychosocial orientation. The subject, Aiken Drum, summarized his personality inventory, displays a fundamental dysfunction in the imaginative sense. He's essentially flawed in his ability to perceive the social and personal consequences of his own actions, and is self-centered to a deleterious degree. He has proved resistant to all techniques of moral impression. But Aiken Drum was charming, and Aiken Drum had a roguish sense of humor, and Aiken Drum, for all his rascal ways, was a natural leader. He was clever with his hands, and ingenious in dreaming up new ways to outrage the established order, so his contemporaries tended to view him as a shadow hero. Even Delriata's adults, harried by the awesome task of raising an entire generation of test tube colonists to populate an empty new world, had to laugh at some of his enormities. When Aiken Drum was 12, his Ecology Corps crew was charged with the cleanup of a putrefying cetacean carcass that had washed up on the beach of the planet's fourth-largest settlement. Saner heads among the children voted for bulldozing the 20-ton mess into the sand above high tide level, but Aiken convinced them to try a more spectacular means of disposal. So they had blown up the dead whale with plastic explosive of Aiken's concoction. Fist-sized gouts of stinking flesh showered the entire town, including a visiting delegation of milieu dignitaries. When Aiken Drum was 13, he had worked with a crew of civil engineers, diverting the course of a small waterfall so that it would help feed the newly completed Old Man of the Mountain Reservoir. Late one night, Aiken and a gang of young Confederates stole quantities of cement and conduit and modified the rocks at the rim of the falls. Dawn on Delriata revealed a passable simulacrum of gigantic male urogenital organs taking a leak into the reservoir 40 meters below. When Aiken Drum was 14, he stowed his small body away on a luxury liner bound for Caledonia. The passengers were victimized by thefts of jewelry, but monitors showed that no human thief had entered their rooms. A search of the cargo deck revealed the young stowaway and the radio-controlled robot mouse he had sent foraging, programmed to sniff out precious metals and gemstones that the boy calmly admitted he planned to fence in New Glasgow. They sent him home, of course, and the behaviorists had still another shot at redirecting Aiken's errant steps toward the narrow road of virtue, but the conditioning never took. "He breaks your heart," one psychologist admitted to another. "You can't help but like the kid, and he's got a brilliantly inventive mind in that troll bod of his. But what the hell are we going to do with him? The galactic milieu just has no niche for Till Eulenspiegel." They had tried redirecting his narcissism into comedic entertainment, but his fellow troopers nearly lynched him when he queered their acts with practical jokes. They tried to harness his mechanical ability, but he used the engineering school facilities to build outlaw black boxes that gave illegal access to half the computerized credit systems in the sector. They tried metaphysic, deep redact and deprivation conditioning, multi-phase electroshock and narcotherapy, and old-time religion. Aiken Drum's wickedness triumphed over all. And so, when he reached an unrepentant 21st birthday, Aiken Drum was confronted with a multiple-choice question, the answer to which would shape his future. "As a confirmed recidivist, counterproductive to the ultimate harmony of the galactic milieu, which of these options do you choose? A. Permanent incarceration in Delriata Correctional Institution. B. Psychosurgical implant of a docilization unit. C. Euthanasia." "None of the above," said Aiken Drum. "I choose exile."
7. Sister Anna Maria Recaro first met Claude when he brought his dying wife to the Oregon Cascade Hospice. Both of the old people had been salvage exopaleontologists, Claude Majeski specializing in macrofossils and Genevieve Logan in micros. They had been married for more than 90 years and one rejuvenation, and together they had surveyed the extinct life forms of more than 20 planets colonized by humanity. But Genevieve had grown weary at last and refused a third lifetime, and Claude had concurred in her decision as he had throughout most of their time together. They stayed in harness as long as possible, then spent a few declining years in their cottage on the Pacific coast of Old World North America. Claude never thought about the inevitable end until it was upon them. He had a vague notion that they would someday drift off quietly together in their sleep. The reality, of course, was less tidy. Claude's Polish peasant body proved in the end to have a much greater staying power than that of his Afro-American wife. The time came when Genevieve had to go to the hospice with Claude accompanying her. They were welcomed by Sister Recaro, a tall and open-faced woman who took personal charge of the physical and spiritual consolation of the dying scientist and her husband. Genevieve, riddled with osteoporosis, partly paralyzed, and dulled by a series of small strokes, was a long time passing. She may have been aware of her husband's efforts to comfort her, but she gave very little evidence of it. Suffering no pain, she spent her days sedated in a dreamy reverie or in sleep. Sister Recaro found that more and more of her professional efforts were devoted to dealing with Claude, who was frustrated and deeply depressed by his wife's slow drift toward life's end. The old man was still physically sturdy at the age of 133, so the nun often took him walking in the mountains. They tramped the misty evergreen forests of the Cascade Range and fished for trout in streams running off the Mount Hood glaciers. They checklisted birds and wildflowers as high summer came on, climbed the flanks of Hood, and spent hot afternoons sitting in the shade on the mountainside without speaking, for Majeski was unable or unwilling to verbalize his grief. One morning, in the early July of 2110, Genevieve Logan began to sink quickly. She and Claude could only touch one another now, since she could no longer see or hear or speak. When the sick room monitor showed that the old woman's brain had ceased to function, the sisters celebrated the mass of departure and gave the last anointing. Claude turned off the machines himself and sat beside the bed, holding Genevieve's skeletal brown hand until the warmth left it. Sister Recaro gently pressed the wrinkled coffee-colored lids down over the dead scientist's eyes. "Would you like to stay with her a while, Claude?" The old man smiled absently. "She's not here, Emery. Would you walk with me, if no one else needs you for a while? It's still early. I think I'd like to talk." So they put on boots and went out again to the mountain, the trip via Egg taking only a few minutes. Parking at Cloudcap, they ascended Cooper's Spur by an easy trail and came to a halt below Tyon Rock, on a ridge at the 2,800-meter level. They found a comfortable place to sit and took out canteens and lunches. Just below was Hood's Elliott Glacier. To the north, beyond the Columbia River Gorge, were Mount Adams and distant Rainier, both snow-crowned like Hood. The symmetrical cone of Mount St. Helens to the west downriver sent up a gray plume of smoke and volcanic steam. Majeski said, "Pretty up here, isn't it? When Jen and I were kids, St. Helens was cold. They were still logging the forests. Dams blocked the Columbia, so the salmon had to climb upstream on fish ladders. Port Oregon Metro was still called Portland and Fort Vancouver. And there was a little smog and some overcrowding if you wanted to live where the jobs were. But all in all,
Life was pretty good out here. Even in the bad old days when St. Helens erupted, it was only toward the very end before the intervention when the world was running out of energy and the techno-economy collapsing that this Pacific Northwest country started to share some of the griefs of the rest of the world.
He pointed eastward toward the dry canyons and the high desert scrub of the old lava plateau beyond the Cascades.
Out there lie the John Day fossil beds. Jen and I did our first collecting there when we were students. Maybe 30 or 40 million years ago, that desert was a lush meadowland with forested hills. It had a big population of mammals. Rhinos, horses, camels, oreodonts, we call them cookie monsters, and even giant dogs and saber-toothed cats. Then one day, the volcanoes began to erupt. They spread a deep blanket of ash and debris all over these eastern plains. The plants were buried and the streams and lakes were poisoned. There were pyroclastic flows, kind of a fiery cloud made of gas and ash and bits of lava, racing along faster than 150 kilometers an hour.
He slowly unwrapped a sandwich, bit, and chewed. The nun said nothing. She took off her bandana headscarf and used it to wipe the sweat from her wide brow.
No matter how fast or how far those poor animals ran, they couldn't escape. They were buried in the layers of ash. And then the volcanism stopped. Rain washed away the poisons, and the plants came back. After a while, the animals returned too and repopulated the land. But the good life didn't last. The volcanoes erupted again, and there were more showers of ashes. It happened over and over again throughout the next 15 million years or so. The killing and the repopulating. The shower of death and the return of life. Layer after layer of fossils and ashes were laid down out there. The John Day Formation is more than 0.5 kilometers thick, and there are similar formations above and below it.
As the old man spoke, the nun sat staring at the tableland to the east. A pair of giant condors circled slowly in a thermal. Below them, a tight formation of 9 egg-shaped flying craft wafted slowly along the course of an invisible canyon.
The ash beds were capped with thick lava. Then, after more millions of years, rivers cut down through the rock and into the ash layers below. Jen and I found fossils along the watercourses. Not just bones and teeth, but even leaf prints and whole flowers pressed into the finer layers of ash. The records of a whole series of vanished worlds. Very poignant. At night, she and I would make love under the desert stars and look at the Milky Way and Sagittarius. We'd wonder how the constellations had looked to all those extinct animals, and how much longer poor old mankind could hang on before it was buried in its own ash bed, waiting for paleontologists from Sagittarius to come dig us up after another 30 million years. He chuckled. Melodrama. One of the hazards of digging fossils in a romantic setting.
He ate the rest of his sandwich and drank from the canteen. Then he said,
Genevieve.
And was quiet for a long time. Were you shocked by the intervention? Sister Ricardo asked at last. Some of the older people I've counseled seemed almost disappointed that humanity was spared its just ecological deserts.
It was tough on the Schadenfreude crowd, Majeski agreed, grinning. The ones who viewed humankind as a sort of plague organism spoiling what might otherwise have been a pretty good planet. But paleontologists tend to take a long view of life. Some creatures survive, some become extinct. But no matter how great the ecological disaster, the paradox called life keeps on defying entropy and trying to perfect itself. Hard times just seem to help evolution. The Pleistocene Ice Age and pluvials could have killed off all the plant-eating hominids, but instead, the rough climate and the vegetation changes seem to have encouraged some of our ancestors to become meat-eaters. And if you eat meat, you don't have to spend so much time hunting food. You can sit down and learn to think.
Once upon a time, hunter-killer was better?
Hunter doesn't equate with murderer. I don't buy the totally depraved ape-man picture that some ethnologists postulate for human ancestry. There was goodness and altruism in our hominid forebears, just as there's good in most people today.
But evil is real, said the nun. Call it egocentrism or malignant aggression or original sin or whatever, it's there. Eden's gone.
Isn't biblical Eden an ambivalent symbol? It seems to me that the myth simply shows us that self-awareness and intelligence are perilous, and they can be deadly. But consider the alternative to the tree of knowledge. Would anyone want innocence at such a price? Not me, Amory. We really wouldn't want to give back that bite of apple. Even our aggressive instincts and stubborn pride helped make us rulers of the earth.
And one day, maybe of the galaxy?
Claude gave a short laugh.
God knows we used to argue long enough about that notion when the Gee and the Poltroians cooperated with us on salvage digs. The consensus seems to be that, despite our hubris and pushiness, we humans have incredible potential, which justified the intervention before we got ourselves too screwed up. On the other hand, the trouble we caused during the metaphysic flap back in the 80s makes you wonder whether we haven't simply transferred our talent for spoiling to a cosmic stage instead of just a planetary one.
They ate some oranges, and after a time, Claude said,
"Whatever happens, I'm glad that I lived to reach the stars. And I'm glad that Jen and I met, and worked with other thinking beings of goodwill. It's over now, but it was a wonderful adventure."
How did Genevieve feel about your travels?
She was more strongly tied to Earth. Even though she enjoyed the outworld journeyings, she insisted on keeping a home here in the Pacific Northwest, where we had been raised. If we had been able to have children, she might never have agreed to leave. But she was a sickle cell carrier, and the technique for modifying the genetic codon was developed after Jen had passed optimal childbearing age. Later on, when we were ready for rejuvenation, our parenting instincts were pretty well atrophied, and there was so much work to do. So we just kept on doing it together. For 94 years.
Claude. Sister Ricaro reached out her hand to him. A light breeze stirred his short, curly hair.
Do you realize that you're healed?
I knew it would happen. After Jen was dead. It was only her going that was so bad. You see, we'd talked it all out months ago when she was still in control of her faculties and did a lot of commiserating and accepting and emotional purging. But she still had to go. And I had to watch and wait while the person I loved more than my own life slipped farther and farther away, but was never quite gone. Now that she's dead, I'm functional again. I just ask myself, what in the world I'm going to do?
I had to answer the same question, the nun said carefully. Majeski gave a start,
then studied her face as though he had never seen it before.
Amory, a child, you've spent your life consoling needy people, serving the dying and their mourners, and you still have to ask a question like that?
I'm not a child, Claude. I'm a 37-year-old woman, and I've worked at the hospice for 15 of those years. The job has not been easy. I'm burnt out. I had decided that you and Genevieve would be my last clients. My superiors have concurred with my decision to leave the order.
Shocked beyond words, the old man stared at her. She continued,
I found myself becoming isolated, consumed by the emotions of the people I was trying to help. There's been a shriveling of faith, too, Claude.
She gave a small shrug.
The kind of thing that people in the religious life are all too likely to suffer.
A sensible, scientific type like you would probably laugh.
I'd never laugh at you, Amory, and if you really think I'm sensible, maybe I can help you.
She rose up and slapped gritty rock dust off her jeans.
It's time for us to get off this mountain. It'll take at least 2 hours to walk back down to the egg.
And on the way, he insisted, you're going to tell me about your problem and your plans for the future.
Anna Maria Roccaro regarded the very old man with amused exasperation.
Dr. Majeski, you're a retired bone digger, not a spiritual counselor.
You're going to tell me anyhow, in case you don't know it. There's nothing more stubborn in the galactic milieu than a Polak who set his mind to something. And I'm a lot more stubborn than a lot of other Polaks because I've had more time to practice. And besides that, he added slyly, you would never have mentioned your problem at all if you hadn't wanted to talk it over with me. Come on, let's get walking.
He set off slowly down the trail, and she followed. They tramped along in silence for at least 10 minutes before she began to speak.
When I was a little girl, my religious heroes weren't the galactic age saints. I could never identify with Père Teilhard, or Saint Jack the Bodiless, or Eleusio Diamond Mask. I liked the really old-timey mystics. Simeon Stylites, Anthony the Hermit, Dame Julian of Norwich. But today that kind of solitary commitment to penitence is contrary to the Church's new vision of human energetics. We're supposed to chart our individual journey toward perfection within a unity of human and divine love.
Claude grimaced at her over his shoulder.
You lost me, child.
Stripped of the jargon, it means that charitable activity is in. Solitary mysticism is out.
Our galactic age is too busy for anchoresses or hermits. That way of life is supposed to be selfish, escapist, masochistic, and counter to the Church's social evolution.
But you don't think so, is that it, Amory? You want to go off and fast and contemplate in some lonesome spot and suffer and attain enlightenment.
Don't you laugh at me, Claude. I tried to get into a monastery. The Cistercians, Poor Clares, Carmelites. And they took one look at my psychosocial profile and told me to get lost. Counseling, they advised. Not even the Zen Brigittines would give me a chance. But I finally discovered that there is one place where an old-fashioned solitary mystic wouldn't be out of place. Have you ever heard of exile?
What paleobiologist hasn't?
You may know that there's been a sort of underground railroad to it for a good many years. But you may not know that use of the time portal was given official milieu sanction 4 years ago in response to an increasing demand. All kinds of people have gone into exile after undergoing a survival regimen. People from every imaginable educational background and profession from Earth and from the human colonies. All of those time travelers have one thing in common. They want to go on living, but they can't function any longer in this complex, structured world of galactic civilization.
And this is what you've chosen?
My application was accepted more than a month ago.
They came to a tricky scree slope, the remnant of an old avalanche, and concentrated on traversing it safely. When they reached the other side, they rested for a moment. The sun beat down hotly. The retro-evolved condors were gone.
Amory, the old man said. It would be very interesting to see fossil bones with flesh on them.
She elevated an eyebrow.
Isn't this notion a trifle impulsive?
Maybe I've nothing better to do. Seeing Pliocene animals alive would be an interesting wind-up to a long career in paleobiology, and the day-to-day survival aspects wouldn't pose any problem for me. If there's one thing you learn out in the field, it's roughing it in comfort. Maybe I could kind of help you get your hermitage set up. That is, if you wouldn't think I was too great a temptation to your vows. She went into gales of laughter, then stopped and said,
Claude, you're worried about me. You think I'll get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger or trampled by mastodons.
Damn it, Amory. Do you know what you're letting yourself in for? Just because you climb a few tame mountains and catch stocked trout in Oregon, you think you can be a female Francis of Assisi in a howling wilderness?
He looked away, scowling.
God knows what kind of human dregs are wandering around there. I don't want to cramp your style, child. I could just keep an eye on things, bring you food and such. Even those old mystics let the faithful bring 'em offerings, you know. Amory, don't you understand? I wouldn't want anything to spoil your dream.
Abruptly, she threw her arms around him, then stepped back smiling, and for an instant he saw her not in jeans, plaid shirt and bandana, but robed in white homespun with a rope knotted about her waist.
Dr. Majeski, I would be honored to have you as a protector. You may very well be a temptation, but I'll be steadfast and resist your allure, even though I love you very much.
That's settled, then. We'd better get on down and arrange for Genevieve's requiem without delay. We'll take her ashes with us to France and bury her in the Pliocene. Jen would have liked that.
8. The widow of Professor Théo Goudrion had been astounded when the first time-tripper appeared at the gate of the cottage on the slope of the Mont de Lyonnais. It happened in the year 2041. Early in June. She was working in her rose garden, snipping deadheads from the splendid standards of Madame Emilian, and wondering how she would be able to pay the death duties, when a stocky male hiker with a dachshund came striding up the dusty road from Saint-Antoine-des-Vigny. The man knew where he was going. He stopped precisely in front of the gate and waited for her to approach. The little dog sat down one step behind her master's left heel.
"Good evening, monsieur,"
she said in standard English, folding her secateurs and slipping them into the pocket of her black salopette.
"Citizen Angélique Montmagny?"
"I prefer the older form of address, but yes, I am she."
He bowed formally.
"Madame Goudrion, permit me to present myself. Richter, Carl Joseph. I am by profession a poet, and my home has been up to now in Frankfurt. I am here, chère madame, to discuss with you a business proposal concerning the experimental apparatus of your late husband.
I regret that I am no longer able to demonstrate the device."
Madame pursed her lips, the fine beak of her aquiline nose lifted proudly, her small black eyes sparkled with unshed tears.
"Indeed, I am shortly going to have it dismantled so that the more valuable components can be sold."
"You must not! You must not!" cried Richter, taking hold of the top of the gate.
Madame took a step backward and stared at him in astonishment. He was moon-faced, with pale protuberant eyes and thick reddish brows, now hoisted in dismay.
Expensively dressed as for a strenuous walking tour, he wore a large rucksack. To it were lashed a violin case, a lethal-looking dural catapult, and a golfer's umbrella. The stolid dachshund guarded a large parcel of paged books, carefully wrapped in plas and equipped with straps and a carrying handle. Gaining control of his emotions, Richter said,
"Forgive me, madame, but you must not destroy this so wonderful achievement of your late husband. It would be a sacrilege."
"Nevertheless, there are the death duties," said madame.
"You spoke of business, monsieur, but you should know that many journalists have already written about my husband's work."
"I," said Richter, with a faint moue of distaste, "am not a journalist. I am a poet, and I hope you will consider my proposal most seriously." He unzipped a side compartment of the pack and removed a leather card case, from which he extracted a small blue rectangle. He held this out to madame. "Evidence of my bona fides." The blue card was a sight draft on the Bank of Lyon, entitling the bearer to collect an extraordinary amount of money. Madame Gaudrion unlatched the gate.
"Please enter, Monsieur Richter. One trusts the little dog is well-mannered."
Richter picked up his package of books and smiled thinly. "Shotzi is more civilized than most humans." They sat on a stone bench below a beloud arch of Soleil d'Or, and Richter explained to the widow why he had come. He had learned of Gaudrion's timegate at a publisher's cocktail party in Frankfurt, and decided that very evening to sell everything that he owned and hasten to Lyon.
"It is very simple, madame. I wish to pass through this time portal and live permanently amid the prehistoric simplicity of the Pliocene epoch. The peaceable kingdom, Locus Aminus, the forest of Arden, the sanctuary of innocence, the halcyon land unwatered by human tears."
He paused and tapped the blue card still in her hand.
"I am willing to pay handsomely for my passage."
"A madman,"
madame fingered the secateurs deep in her pocket.
"The time gate," she said carefully, "opens in but a single direction. There is no return, and we have no detailed knowledge of what lies on the other side of the Pliocene land. It was never possible to circumtranslate tri-D cameras or other types of recording equipment."
"The fauna of the epoch is well known, madame, as is the climate. A prudent person need have nothing to fear, and you, gnädige Frau, must suffer no qualms of conscience in permitting me to use the portal. I am self-sufficient, and well able to look after myself in a wilderness. I have selected my equipment with care, and for companionship, there is my faithful Shotzi.
Don't hesitate, I beg of you. Let me pass through tonight, now!"
A madman indeed, but perhaps one that Providence had sent. She remonstrated with him for some time while the sky darkened to indigo and the nightingales began to sing. Richter parried all of her objections. He had no family to miss him. He had told no one of his intentions, so there would be no inquiries made of her. No one had observed him walking on the lonely road from the village. She would be rendering him a blessing, fulfilling for him what had once been an impossible dream of Arcady. He was not committing suicide, he was merely entering a new, more tranquil life. But if she refused him, his Zianqual would leave him only the grimmest alternative. And there was the money.
"C'est entendu," madame said at last. "Please accompany me."
She led him down into the cellar and threw on the lights. There stood the gazebo with its cables just as poor Theo had left it. The poet gave a joyous cry and rushed to the apparatus, tears running down his round cheeks.
"At last!"
The dachshund trotted sedately after her master. Madame picked up the parcel of books and placed it inside the lattice.
"Quickly, madame, quickly!"
Richter clasped his hands in a paroxysm of exultation.
"Listen to me," she said sharply. "When you have been translated, you must immediately remove yourself from the point of your arrival.
Walk 3 or 4 meters away and take the dog with you. Is this clear? Otherwise you will be snatched back into the present day as a dead man and crumble to dust.
I understand. Vite, madame. Vite, quickly.
Trembling, she moved to the simple control panel and activated the time portal. The mirrored force field sprang up, and the poet's voice was silenced as if by a broken teleview connection. The old woman sank down on her knees and recited the angelic salutation 3 times, then got up and switched off the power. The mirrors vanished. The gazebo was empty.
Madame Coutrion let a great sigh escape her lips. Then she thriftily turned out the cellar lights and mounted the stairs, fingering the small slip of blue plaz tucked securely in her pocket. After Carl Josef Richter, there were others. The very first gratuity allowed Madame to pay the inheritance tax and discharge all of her other debts. Some months later, after her mind had been fully opened to the Time Gate's profit-making potential by the coming of other visitors, she let it be known that she was establishing a quiet auberge for walking tourists. She purchased land adjoining her cottage and had a handsome guest house built. The rose gardens were expanded, and several of her relatives drafted to assist with domestic duties. To the astonishment of skeptical neighbors, the inn prospered. Not all of the guests who entered Chez Goudrion were seen to leave, but the point was moot, since Madame invariably required payment in advance. Some years passed. Madame underwent rejuvenation and displayed an austere chic in her second lifetime. In the valley below the inn, the most ancient urban center in France also underwent graceful transition, as did all of the metropolitan centers of old Earth in those middle years of the 21st century. Every trace of the ugly, ecologically destructive technology was gradually obliterated from the great city at the confluence of the Rhône and Saône. Necessary manufacturing establishments, service and transit systems were relocated in underground infrastructures. As the surplus population of Lyon was siphoned off to the new planets, empty slums and dreary suburbs faded into meadows and forest reserves, dotted here and there with garden villages or efficient habitat complexes. Lyon's historic structures, representing every century for the more than 2,000 years of its lifetime, were refurbished and displayed like jewels in appropriate natural settings. Laboratories, offices, hotels, and commercial enterprises were tucked into recycled buildings or disguised to harmonize with the ambiance of nearby monuments. Plaisances and boulevards replaced the hideous concrete auto routes. Amusement sites, picturesque alleys of small shops, and cultural foundations multiplied as colonials began returning to the old world from the far-flung stars, seeking their ethnic heritage. Other types of seekers also came to Lyon. These found their way to the inn in the western foothills, now called Auberge du Portal, where Madame Goudrion personally made them welcome. In those early years when she still regarded the time portal as a business venture, Madame set up simple criteria for her clientele. Would-be timefarers had to spend at least 2 days with her at the auberge while she and her computer checked civil status and psychosocial profile. She would send no one through the gate who was a fugitive from justice, who was seriously deranged, or who had not attained 28 years of age, for the great step demanded full maturity. She would permit no one to carry modern weaponry or coercive devices back to the Pliocene. Only the simplest solar-powered or sealed pack machines might be taken. Persons obviously unprepared for survival in a primeval wilderness were dismissed and told to return upon acquiring suitable skills. After thinking deeply on the matter, Madame made a further condition for women candidates. They must renounce their fertility.
Attendez!
She would snap at the stunned female applicant in her unreconstructed Gallic way.
Consider the inescapable lot of womankind in a primitive world. Her destiny is to bear child after child until her body is worn out, submitting all the while to the whims of her male overlord.
It is true that we modern women have complete control of our bodies, as well as the ability to defend ourselves from outrage. But what of the daughters who might be born to you in the ancient epoch? You will not possess the technology to transfer your reproductive freedom to them. And with the return of the old biological pattern comes also the return of the old subservient mindset. When your daughters matured, they would surely be enslaved. Would you consign a loved child to such a fate?
There was also the matter of paradox. The notion that time travelers might disrupt the present world by meddling with the past had seriously troubled Madame Gudrun for many weeks after the departure of Carl Josef Richter. She had concluded at last that such a paradox must be impossible, since the past is already manifest in the present, with the continuum sustained in the loving hands of le bon Dieu. On the other hand, one ought not to take chances. Human beings, even the rejuvenated and highly educated people of the coagulant galactic age, could have little impact on the Pliocene or any subsequent time period if they were restrained from reproducing. Given the social advantage to female travelers, the decision to demand the renouncing of motherhood as a condition of transport was confirmed in Madame's mind. She would say to the protesters, "One realizes that it is unfair, that it sacrifices a portion of your feminine nature. Do I not understand? I, whose two dear children died before reaching adulthood. But you must accept that this world you seek to enter is not one of life. It is a refuge of misfits, a death surrogate, a rejection of normal human destiny. Ainsi, if you pass into this exile, the consequences must rest upon you alone. If life's force is still urgent within you, then you should remain here. Only those who are bereaved of all joy in this present world may take refuge in the shadows of the past."
After hearing this somber speech, the women applicants would ponder and at last agree, or else depart from the auberge, never to return. Male time travelers came to outnumber the female by nearly 4-1. Madame was not greatly surprised. The existence of the time gate came to the attention of local authorities some 3 years after the Auberge du Portel commenced operation, when there was an unfortunate incident involving a refused applicant. But Madame's high-powered Lyon solicitors were able to prove that the enterprise violated no local or galactic statute. It was licensed as a public accommodation, a common carrier, a psychosocial counseling service, and a travel agency. From time to time thereafter, certain local government bodies made stabs at suppression or regulation. They always failed, because there were no precedents, and besides, the time gate was useful.
"I do a work of mercy," Madame Gudrun told one investigatory panel. "It is a work that would have been incomprehensible scarcely 100 years ago, but now, in this galactic age, it is a blessing. One need only study the dossiers of the pathetic ones themselves to see that they are out of place in the swift-paced modern world. There have always been such persons, psychosocial anachronisms, unsuited to the age in which they were born. Until the time portal, these had no hope of altering their fate."
"Are you so confident, madame," a commissioner asked, "that this time portal leads to a better world?"
"It leads to a different and simpler world, at any rate, Citizen Commissioner," she retorted. "That seems sufficient to my clients."
The Auberge kept careful records of those who passed through the Pliocene Gate, and these would later be fascinating fodder for statisticians. For example, the travelers tended to be highly literate, intelligent, socially unconventional, and aesthetically sophisticated. Above all, they were romantic. They were mostly citizens of the old world rather than of the colonial planets. Many of the timefarers had earned their living in the professions, in science, technology, or other high disciplines. An ethnic essay of the travelers showed significant numbers of Anglo-Saxons, Celts, Germans, Slavs, Latins, Native Americans, Arabs, Turks, and other Central Asiatics, and Japanese. There were few African blacks, but numbers of Afro-Americans. Inuit and Polynesian people were attracted by the Pliocene world. Chinese and Indo-Dravidians were not. Fewer agnostics than believers chose to abandon the present, but the devout time travelers were often fanatics or conservatives disillusioned about modern religious trends, particularly the milieu dicta that prescribed revolutionary socialism, jihads, or any style of theocracy. Many non-religious but few Orthodox Jews were tempted to escape to the past. A disproportionate number of Muslims and Catholics wanted to make the trip. The psychoprofiles of the traveler showed that a significant percentage of the applicants was highly aggressive. Small-time ex-convicts were common clients. But the more formidable reformed evildoers apparently preferred the contemporary scene. There was a small but persistent trickle of broken-hearted lovers, both homophile and heterosexual. As was to be expected, many of the applicants were narcissistic and addicted to fantasy. These people were apt to appear at the auberge in the guise of Tarzan or Crusoe or Pocahontas or Rima, or else costumed as throwbacks to every conceivable old-world era and culture. Some, like Richter, outfitted themselves for the journey with Spartan pragmatism. Others wanted to bring along desert island treasures, such as whole libraries of old-fashioned paged books, musical instruments and recordings, elaborate armories or wardrobes. The more practical gathered together livestock, seeds, and tools for homesteading in the style of the Swiss family Robinson. Collectors and naturalists brought their paraphernalia. Writers came equipped with goose quills and flagons of sepia ink, or the latest in voice writers with reams of Durofilm sheets and book plaque transcribers. The frivolous cherished delicacies of food and drink, and psychoactive chemicals. Madame did her utmost to accommodate the impedimenta given the physical restriction of the gazebo's volume, which was roughly 6 cubic meters. She urged the travelers to consider pooling their resources, and sometimes this was done. The gypsies, the Amish, the Russian old believers, and the Inuit were particularly shrewd in such matters. But given the idiosyncratic nature of the timefarers, many preferred to be completely independent of fellow humans, while others ignored practicalities in favor of romantic ideals or precious fetishes. Madame saw to it that each person had the minimal survival necessities, and extra shipments of medical supplies were regularly sent through the gate. Beyond that, one could only trust in Providence. For nearly 65 years, and throughout 2 rejuvenations, Angélique Goudrion personally supervised the psychosocial evaluation of her clients and their eventual dispatch to the Pliocene. As the uneasy cupidity of her early years was finally submerged in compassion for those she served, the fees for passage became highly negotiable and were often waived. The number of prospective travelers increased steadily, and there came to be a long waiting list. By the turn of the 22nd century, more than 90,000 fugitives had passed through the time portal to an unknown fate. In 2106, Madame Goudrion herself entered the Pliocene world called exile. Alone, dressed in her gardening clothes, carrying a simple rucksack and a bundle of cuttings from her favorite roses. Since she had always despised the standard English of the milieu as an insult to her French heritage, the note she left said, "Plus qu'il ne faut." The human polity of the Galactic Concilium was not willing to accept this more-than-enough judgment, however. The time portal obviously filled a need as a glory hole for inconvenient aberrants. Organized in a humane and somewhat more efficient manner, it was allowed to continue in operation. There was no advertisement of the service, and referrals were kept discreetly professional. The ethical dilemma of permitting persons to exile themselves to the Pliocene was tabled. Study confirmed that no time paradox was possible. As for the fate of the travelers, they were all doomed in one way or another anyhow. 9. All the way back to Earth from Brevin Sumirakan, Brian Grenfell planned the way he would do it. He would call Mercy from Unst Starport just as soon as he got through the Deacon, and remind her that she had agreed to go sailing with him. They could meet at Cannes on Friday evening, which would allow him time to drop off the conference data at the CAS in London and pick up some clothes and the boat from his flat. Fair weather was scheduled for the next 3 days, so they could cruise easily to Kos or even Sardinia. In some secluded cove with moonlight on the Mediterranean and soft music playing, he would nail her. "This is your captain speaking. We are 5 minutes from re-entry into normal space above the planet Earth. There will be a momentary discomfort as we pass through the superficies, which may inconvenience sensitive persons. Please do not hesitate to call your flight attendant if you require an anodyne, and remember that your satisfaction is our prime directive. Thank you for traveling, United." Grenfell leaned toward the comm. "Glendisseri and Avion." When the drink appeared, he tossed it off, closed his eyes, and thought of Mercy. Those sad, sea-colored eyes, ringed by the dark lashes, the hair of cedarwood red framing her pale, high-boned cheeks, her body, almost as thin as a child's, but tall and elegant, in a long gown of leaf green with trailing darker ribbons. He could hear her voice, lilting and resonant, as they walked in the apple orchard that evening after the medieval pageant. "There is no such thing as love at first sight, Brian. There's only sex at first sight. And if my scrawny charms inflame you, then let's lie together, because you're a sweet man, and I'm in need of comfort. But don't talk about love." He had, though. He couldn't help it. Realizing the illogic of the thing, observing himself from afar with a chagrined detachment, but still unable to control the situation, he knew he loved her from the first moment they met. Carefully, he had tried to explain without appearing a complete ass. She had only laughed and pulled him down onto the petal-strewn lawn. Their passion had delighted them both, but brought him no true release. He was caught by her. He would have to share her life forever or go in misery apart. Only one day with her? One day before he had to travel to the important meeting on the Paltroian planet. She had wanted him to stay, suggesting the sailing holiday, but he, duty-bound, had put her off. Imbecile! She might have needed him. How could he have left her alone? Only one day. Brian's old friend, Gaston Deschamps, encountered fortuitously in a Paris restaurant, had invited him to kill some empty hours, observing the Fête d'Auvergne from behind the scenes. Gaston, the pageant director, had called it a droll exercise in applied ethnology. And so it had been, until the introduction. "Now we will return to those thrilling days d'antan," Gaston had proclaimed, after giving him the 50-pence tour of the village and the chateau. The director had led the way to a high tower, thrown open the door to the elaborate pageant control room, and she had been sitting there. "You must meet my fellow wonder worker, the associate director of the fête and the most medieval lady now alive in the galactic milieu, Mademoiselle Mercedes Lamballe." She had looked up from her console and smiled, piercing him to the heart. "This is your captain speaking. We are now re-entering normal space above the planet Earth. The procedure will take only 2 seconds, so please bear with us during the brief period of mild discomfort." Zang. Tooth extraction, hammered thumb, wanged funny bone. Zang. "Thank you for your patience, ladies and gentlemen, and distinguished passengers of other sexes. We'll be landing at Unst Starport in the beautiful Shetland Islands of Earth at exactly 1500 hours planet mean time." Grenfell mopped his high brow and ordered another drink. This time, he sipped. Unbidden, an ancient song began unreeling in his mind, and he smiled because the song was so like Mercy. "There is a lady, sweet and kind, was never face so pleased my mind. I did but see her passing by, and yet I love her till I die." He would take the tube to Nice and egg onto Cannes. She would be waiting for him at the quay of that peaceful old town, perhaps wearing a green playsuit. Her eyes would have that expression of gentle melancholy, and be green or gray, changeable as the sea and as deep. He would stagger up with his duffel bag and a fitted picnic hamper full of food and drink. Champagne, Stilton, goose liver sausage, sweet butter, long loaves, oranges, black cherries. And he would trip over his feet, and she would smile at last. He would take out the boat and make the small boys at the slip stand back. There were always small boys, now that families had rediscovered the quiet Côte d'Azur. He would attach the thin tube of the tiny inflator and throw the wadded packet of silver and black decamol film into the water. Slowly, slowly, as the boys gaped, the 8-meter sloop would grow. Bulb keels, hull, decks, furniture fixed below, cabin, cockpit, railings, mast. Then he would produce the separate pieces, rudder and tiller, stabilizer, boom with sails still furled, lines, deck seats, lockers, buckets, bedding and all, born miraculously of taut decamol and compressed air. Dockside dispensers would fill the keels and stabilizers with mercury and ballast the rest of the boat and its fittings with distilled water, adding mass to the rigid microstructure of the decamol. He would rent the auxiliary, the lamps, pumps, navigear, the gooseneck, CQR anchor, and other hardware, pay off the harbor master, and bribe the small boys not to spit over the quayside into the cockpit. She would board, he would cast off. With a fresh breeze, it would be up sail for Ajaccio, and somehow, in the next days, he would get her to agree to marry him. I did but see her passing by. When the starship landed in the beautiful Shetlands, it was 6 degrees Celsius and blowing a dreary northeast gale. Mercedes Lamballe's teleview number responded with a subscriber canceled service notice. In a panic, Grenfell finally got hold of Gaston Deschamps. The pageant director was evasive, then angry, then apologetic. "The fact is, Bri, the damn woman's chucked it. Must have been the day after you went off-world 2 months ago. Left us flat. And the busiest time of the season, too." "But where, Gaston? Where's she gone?" On the view screen, Deschamps let his gaze slide away. "Through that damn time portal into exile. I'm sick about it, Bri. She had everything to live for. A bit off her bonk, of course, but none of us suspected she was that far gone. It's a damn shame. She had the best feel for the medieval of anyone I've ever known." "I see. Thanks for telling me. I'm very sorry." He broke the connection and sat in the teleview kiosk. A middle-aged anthropologist of some reputation, mild-faced, conservatively dressed, holding a portfolio full of Proceedings of the 15th Galactic Conference on Culture Theory. Two Symbiari, who had come in on the same ship with him, waited patiently outside for some minutes before tapping on the kiosk door, leaving little green smears on the window. "And yet, I love her." Brian Grenfell held up an apologetic finger to the Symbiari and turned back to the teleview. He touched the number stall. "Information for what city, please?" "Lyon," he said. "Till I die." Brian posted the data to the CAS and picked up his own egg in London. Even though he could have done the research just as easily at home, he took off for France that same afternoon. Installing himself in the Galaxy Lyon, he ordered a supper of grilled langouste, orange soufflé, and chablis, and immediately began to search the literature. The library unit in his room displayed a depressingly long list of books, theses, and articles on the Gudrian time portal. He thought about skipping over those catalogued under physics and paleobiology and concentrating on the psychoanalogy and psychosociology entries. But this seemed unworthy of her, so he poked his card into the slot and resignedly ordered the entire collection. The machine spat out enough thin plaque books to pave the large hotel room 6 times over. He sorted them methodically and began to assimilate, projecting some, reading others, sleep-soaking the most tedious. 3 days later, he fed the books back into the unit. He checked out of the hotel and requested his egg, then went up to the roof to wait for it. The corpus he had just absorbed sloshed about in his mind without form or structure. He knew he was subconsciously rejecting it and its implications, but the realization was no great help. Broken hearts healed, and memories of vanished love faded away, even of this strange love, whose like he had never known before. He realized that this had to be true. Measured judgment, consideration of the scary data he had stuffed himself with, common sense uncharged with emotion, told him what he must do. Sensibly do. Oh, mercy. Oh, my dear. The uttermost part of the galaxy is nearer than you are, my lady passing by. And yet. 10. Only Georgina had been sorry to hear that Stein was going. They had got gloriously drunk together on his last day in Lisboa, and she'd said, "How'd you like to do it in a volcano?" And he had muttered fondly that she was a crazy fat broad, but she assured him that she knew a guy who would, for suitable consideration, look the other way while they took a research deep driller out of Messina, where there was this adit that led right into the main chamber of Stromboli. So what the hell? They egged on over, and the guy did let them get away with it. So what if it cost 6 kilobucks? It was seismic down there in the surging lava, with colored gas bubbles oozing slowly up the observation window like a bunch of jellyfish in a bowl of incandescent tomato soup. "Oh, Georgina," he had moaned in the post-coital tryst. "Come with me." She rolled over on the padded floor of the driller cockpit, white flesh turned to scarlet and black by the glare outside, and gave the weeping giant mother comfort from her melon-sized breasts.